The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Papiss Demba-Cisse. That's all. Just Papiss Demba-Cisse. All pod long. Senegalese does it as Newcastle triumph at Stamford Bridge. And next up for Magpies, it's the big one with Manchester City, while language experts puzzled as Cisse does not mean to stop. Meanwhile, in other bits that we'll cram in, Chelsea, they have the FA Cup final with Liverpool, and not just any Liverpool, but the first red side ever to lose a league game to Fulham. We round up the weekend's action in prospect and the latest from Europe too. Real Madrid champions, Montpellier not champions, and fists flying at Fiorentina. Delia Rossi fired by Laviola for hitting his own player. All of that, plus post tweets and why Belgium aren't very good in Football Weekly Extra. Well, very few pods left in this season of seasons, and very few pods with the potential to be as exciting as this one, as we welcome back Amy Lawrence. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Paul Doyle making an all too rare appearance.
Hi, James.
And a first ever pod appearance by the entity now known as Greg
Bukowski.
Bukowski.
Hello.
Hi, Greg.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
It is.
Yeah, making my debut late on in this season.
Fantastic stuff. All right, then. Well, so many things to talk about, but Cisse, eh?
Well, what a goal. Amazing goal.
What a moment.
Well, I'm talking to Jacob Steinberg about it this morning, and it's the kind of strike which probably you get right one time out of 100, because it's for that strike to happen, it came off the outside of his boot and it swung in like a boomerang, and generally would go like to the left about 30 yards on the floor and hit the hoardings, and people would laugh about it. But it was such a special strike, and I mean, it wasn't one of the crankies in goal, it was Peter Cech as well. You know, he's a big goalkeeper,
and it
looped over, it couldn't get near it, and to do that in a match in which Newcastle desperately needed the points, and he could have held the ball in the corner, yeah. showed the kind of confidence that Newcastle have had this season, you know.
When he got the ball and fired, I thought, well, that's silly, he just punted it into the stands. And then it was like a kid on a PlayStation, to borrow Gary Neville's expression, but in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, you see players slash their foot across the ball and shoot like that from time to time, not from so wide an angle. And as Greg said, it's kind of a 1 in 100 shot, and Cisse has scored with quite a few 1 in 100 shots, which makes you wonder, can he keep doing this? Can he do this again next season? And if so, if he really is that good, then it's amazing that Newcastle got him for only 9 million, and apparently nobody else was in for him. I know Arsene Wenger was asked a few weeks ago at a press conference if he had looked at him, and he said, yeah, but you can't sign everyone. And now we know that he seems to have gone for Podolski instead. Be interesting to see how that pans out.
Well, Rafael Honigstein had for some time been flagging him up, and he was consistently kind of second top scorer, I think, in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, he scored loads of goals. I didn't see a lot of those goals, so I don't know what sort of goals they were. So far, he seems to be able to score from anywhere at any time.
Yeah, because his first goal wasn't bad either.
His first goal was lovely, and that first touch was almost equally as lovely as the finish. And I think it's interesting, people have this theory that you can't buy value in January, and Cisse seems to have knocked that one in the head pretty convincingly by himself.
So has Jelovic at Everton.
Mm. Quite.
Even Pogrebniak at Fulham.
Yeah, well. And
I should be able to pronounce names like that now, really.
Vazte at West Ham.
But the other thing, of course, is that, you know, looking at that goal, I couldn't quite work out, the second goal, that is, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing that Gary Neville wasn't commentating.
Huge win, though, for Newcastle.
Brilliant. And I think it's when you look at the three teams now vying for those last two Champions League spots, it really can be any combination. I don't think it's by any means certain that, even though Arsenal have the point advantage at this moment, that they're going to, you know, they could easily, probably being the team that's least in form of the three at the moment, struggle a bit, because they do look very jaded for quite inexplicable reasons. And Newcastle and Spurs, you know, both had fantastic away performances. And I think probably the one for Spurs at Bolton looked like the most difficult of their games. So
it's the first away win of 2012. The England curse lifted.
Yes,
and almost magically they go back to their free scoring ways, and there they go to 1 point behind Arsenal. Their goal difference massively boosted by that. It's only one worse off than the Gunners now. So very interesting top four story. Arsenal 1 point better off than Newcastle and Spurs. They've got Norwich at home this weekend. Then they travel to West Brom for Roy Hodgson's last match. No Arteta, though. And they don't win without Arteta, do they?
Well, they'll win at the weekend against Norwich, because although Arsenal may be looking jaded, Norwich are looking even more so. And they've become a bit of a rabble towards the end of the season, which is understandable given that it's mostly the team is made up of players who were in League One 2 years ago, and they've done extraordinarily well, but they're finding it hard to hold it together in the last few weeks, and they've looked really ragged in recent weeks. So if Arsenal don't win that comfortably, then and they've no business being in the Champions League.
I still think that Chelsea probably fancy themselves for nicking that Champions League spot, though, through the Champions League. I mean, it's a one-off game for them, and as much as it's at the Allianz Arena, I think they'll look at that as, and they probably looked at the league games and thought, well, the chances are gone in the league, and you know, for a one-off chance to qualify for the Champions League and the glory of winning it as well. I think, you know, with the bookies, they're probably quite doing a Sean Ingle here. With the bookies, they're probably, you know, quite good odds for getting that spot, and you're seeing off whoever the fourth place team is, whether that's Tottenham, Arsenal, Newcastle, you know.
Yeah. Well, Chelsea have that advantage of they can finish fourth and not worry about whoever wins the Champions League, because
they won't finish fourth, though. I think that's
look at their last two fixtures. They finish off against Blackburn. Before that, they go to Anfield, where everybody wins now.
I know, that's very true. Yeah. I still think Spurs. They've got Villa away, and I think they'll win that game. And they've got Fulham at home. I just think Spurs are probably going to get fourth. I think that, you know, as much as I think Newcastle kind of ruined the chances with that game at Wigan, and particularly with Man City turning up there, they might get a point against Man City and ruin City's chances. Oof. And also their own.
Probably is.
Hey,
if Newcastle win both their last two games, they'll probably still finish outside.
Yeah, right, that's the thing. I just think the chances are
really gone. Because you think Spurs and Arsenal will be able to just hold them off?
I'm not so sure.
Well, the big question is Arsenal's game at West Brom. I wouldn't say that's a foregone conclusion.
Roy Hodgson's last match, of course, a very emotional affair that'll be. And as we mentioned before, that it's Norwich. We said what Tottenham are doing. And Newcastle, Man City visiting them at the erstwhile St James's Park this weekend. They finish off at Everton. It's not an easy fixture. Not an easy fixture, but then neither was visiting Stamford Bridge against a Roberto Di Matteo side that was really fired up for this one. We're going to talk more about Newcastle Man City later on. But then, of course, the next game for Chelsea is against Liverpool, but at Wembley in the FA Cup final. Greg, I know you're still scrambling for tickets.
Yeah, I am, and I'm waiting for a call that Paul Doyle's going to take, hopefully within this pod in there. Yeah, tell me that I've been lucky, you know. I didn't get enough credit, so I'm hoping to get tickets for this one.
Because there's a scandalously small allocation for real fans.
Yeah, and we were talking about this. I mean, it's the same every year. It's always, you know, around 25,000 each when the capacity's almost 90,000 now, which,
right.
I mean, it is scandalous, particularly the amount of other people that get tickets from corporations, the FA, and I mean, surely there can't be that many other, you know, tickets to give to. I don't know who these people are, who, you know, these people who I'm going to get my tickets off in the city, who work at a bank or something.
I'd be really fascinated to know how many of the many thousands of tickets that the FA have always, their reasoning behind giving this allocation, the small allocation to the two clubs involved, is that they have to make sure all the people who work in for the good of the game all over the country get their reward, and the county FAs and so on and so forth always get plenty of tickets. All other clubs, regardless of where they are in the league, get an allocation of tickets. But the proportion of these surely end up with fans, with people like you, Greg, who end up having to scramble around to find them. And I'd love to know how many of these that are so-called going to the rest of the game are actually used by those people in the rest of the game, because I'd suggest it's a very small amount.
Yeah.
Well, you'd hate to miss it, because it's only going to be the 30th time that Liverpool and Chelsea have faced each other in the last seven seasons, Greg.
Yeah,
30?
Yeah.
How have they been doing that?
Have they
had pre-season tours against each other?
Yeah, pretty much, I think. I think there's been all kinds of games. We've played each other in every tournament, every
but
cup
that
competition.
Can't be right.
There's a Liverpool
30
and Chelsea
times
fixture.
Since 2005. Yeah.
The Champions League, naming off every year, Liverpool and Chelsea played each other, whether it was in the knockout stages or in the groups, and then the Carling Cup they've met, and then, in the FA Cup final, this is obviously a first, so.
Very few of them have been decent games.
I know,
from a neutral perspective.
Yeah.
Like, given there's going to be so many neutrals at the match,
I don't think it'll be shit on a stick this time round. Anyway, because I think both teams have got obvious weaknesses, so I think there could be goals. And also, there's so many players for Chelsea who aren't going to make the Champions League final. We'll see this as their last big farewell possibly. So I mean, I think they'll be very strong against Liverpool, and I mean, you don't know what Liverpool team is gonna you know.
Well, let's talk about Chelsea for a second. As you say, there are players who will be available for this game, like Ivanovic, who won't be for the Champions League final. Terry's another
Morelos,
one.
Ramirez, very important.
But
players.
No Cahill, no Luis. They did look vulnerable at the back.
Yeah, and I think there'll be goals in this, but I also think you know they'll pose an attacking threat as well, because Liverpool have been quite poor off crosses this season and been caught out on quite a number of occasions.
Do you think it'll be Drogba or going with the Torres v his old club angle for Dimitar?
I still think he'll go with Drogba. Because, yeah, I mean he can still get a performance out of him in that game, and then there's enough time till the Champions League final, just two matches, you know.
Yeah. He's a big Wembley player as well, isn't he, Drogba?
Yeah, I mean the goal he scored against Spurs in the semi final was classic Drogba, brilliant, you know. His first touch was amazing, strength turned and he hit a Cissé like shot, you know.
But having said all that, I mean, we were talking... sorry, Paul.
No, I was just going to say there's a case for playing them both in a 4-3-3 with Torres being wide on the right. He's shown himself to be a brilliant crosser, even when he's been a poor finisher. Yeah.
Well, Dimitar's got options. I think it's fair to say, after seeing Liverpool against Fulham on Tuesday, that Kenny Dalglish doesn't have any options at all. He has to go with his first choice. He left nine of them out in the game against Cottagers, who had never won, an unbelievable statistic, any league game ever in the city of Liverpool.
It was just a non-entity of a game. I mean, it was like there was 32,000 at Anfield, and I think that was even including tickets like mine. My empty seat was watching the match because I couldn't actually give my ticket away for that match, as much as I tried. And there was nothing happened. It was like a reserve match. I mean, the own goal was a comical thing. And then there's just two teams with players running around, not wanting to get injured. I mean, Fulham had more of a go, but the Liverpool players, you would have thought some of them would have tried to, you know, kind of do something to earn a place. And I think now that Dalglish will leave Carroll out for the FA Cup final. And one player who's benefited from, probably unexpectedly, from Carroll being left out is Jonjo Shelvey. And he's a player who was bought in for £1.5 million.
He looked quite lively.
Yeah, wasn't much expected of him, but he's actually done... He's done reasonably well over the last 3 months, and he's still only 20 years of age. So I think he allows Gerrard to play closer to Suarez, and he's got the brain to understand Suarez's runs, probably one of the only players who can at Liverpool, and can feed him and get the most out of him. And Suarez can play as an out-and-out striker with Gerrard close to him, whereas when Gerrard's not close to him, he can play as a support striker.
Which is far more the setup they had at Carrow Road at the weekend when they had that 3-0 win. The Plus One, commenting on Tuesday's pod, says, far be it from me to channel, etc., the panel's running list, etc., but I've just got to the end of the podcast. There's no mention of Suarez's goal from near the halfway line. It's true. We didn't even touch on Luis's hat trick.
I think it was a brilliant shot, obviously, but I think the keeper should have saved that. His feet were very slow as he backpedaled.
We still fancy. I think that's a goal of the season contender with Cissé and with Crouch, and I think Cissé just gets it over both of those. Because the other ones, I think you could do more, like we said, out of 100, I think Suarez could do that more than once out of 100 attempts. I think Crouch could do that more.
See,
than
I'm
once
a bit uncomfortable with you talking about Cissé's goal as being a 1 in 100, because the thing about him is that, 13 goals now in 12, he seems to do it every time. The ball flips up off his foot, no problem, I'll just volley in with my other.
That was like some kind of Darren Brown thing or something, you know. It was like a, I don't know. It was like,
I don't think he just hit it and hoped. I think that's something very special.
No, I think he went for it, but I do think that the amount of times that happens is so few. And even a player who hits the ball as well as he do, the bend on it was phenomenal.
It was. Yeah.
So we've talked about it twice now in this podcast.
No, it's not enough. Reminiscent of... a Sega Mega Drive game, I think.
I wonder if Fernando Torres was at the other end watching that and saying, I wonder if he'll still be able to do that in the Premier League after 2 years of being kicked every time he gets the ball.
And what do you think is going to be the final score on Saturday?
0-0.
Really? All right then.
Greg, yeah. I'd like to ask you something.
Oh, go on.
As a Liverpool fan, just I was reading one of the comments from one of the Newcastle fans after the game against Chelsea, and there was this kind of euphoria about their season.
Yeah.
And all, you know, this guy was saying, even if they don't make the Champions League or whatever, this has been the most fantastic season, and they're so thrilled and so on. And I just wondered, you know, I was thinking about whether, as a Liverpool fan, you would swap your season, regardless of what goes on in the FA Cup final, for the kind of season Newcastle have had, even.
Well, yeah, I got asked this by Mike Adamson, the football editor, because he's doing some big debate, and he wanted me to argue one way or the other whether as a Liverpool fan I'd want to win two trophies or would I want fourth place this season. Now, my answer is that Liverpool are so far off fourth place. Had they been a little bit closer, and you could see that some progress was being made in the league, and perhaps they were, you know, sixth or even fifth, and in contention for fourth place still at this stage, I'd say, oh no, fair enough, I'd take the two trophies any time. But I think the fact that there's such a wide gap between the winning the trophies and progressing in the league, I probably would go with a season like Newcastle, in which we've played some, you know, we would have played some great football and challenged, and still being in with a chance of the Champions League now. And I'm not the kind of person who kind of dismisses winning trophies normally, but I just think it's the fact that Liverpool could end up finishing as low as ninth is,
well, indeed,
so disappointing.
It's only goal difference is keeping you out of ninth at the moment. Liverpool have only once finished outside the top eight, as you'll all too certainly know. 1948 it was, and they ended up bottom of the table and relegated.
Yeah, it's not. It's
so Kenny really ran a real risk by dropping, or by leaving out so many of his decent players for the Fulham game. Mm. No,
yeah, well, no, I think he did, and I don't know if he needed to leave out quite as many as that, because I mean, there's fans turning up to watch that match who pay, you know, good money, and you know, and expect to see, you know, some kind of effort, and you know, and it's Fulham as well. I mean, you really got to try and, you know, get points against those teams at home, which Liverpool haven't done this season, but particularly, you know, and when there's people still paying good money to go and watch the football.
Mm. 30 points dropped at home.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
That's it.
30 shots have hit the woodwork.
Oh,
as well.
Stop, yeah, about the woodwork. Yeah. Right. That's it for part one. Very, very shortly, we're going to go all European with Sid and France and all that stuff too.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Sid. Oh, you caught us unaware. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm okay, yeah.
Are you busy writing stuff after this?
I am busy writing. Yeah. About Real Madrid winning the league, as you can
imagine. Yeah, midweek and milestones, I like to call it. You got your Real Madrid winning the league. That caught us all by surprise. And, of course, Leo Messi breaking a scoring record. Again, a bit of a turn up, that one.
I suppose, as you say, the Messi scoring record, each week there seems to be a different one. This one is genuinely huge, of course. It's 68 goals, which takes him ahead of Torpedo Müller's record from 1972-73. Mm. And Real Madrid winning the league, it was coming for a while, but they did have to finally finish it off. And there was I think, a sort of sense of release as well as joy last night with the way that they won the league. And the manner in it of winning it as well was I think... I'm writing about this right now, and I could think of no better way of putting it that Real Madrid last night won the league the way they've won the league, which is that they went away to a supposedly difficult side and just blew them to bits, which is what they've done to most of the tough sides this year. We looked at their run-in, we thought, well, they go to the Calderon, which is difficult, they go to San Mamés, which is difficult, they go to Pamplona, which is difficult, and they go to the Camp Nou, which is difficult. In fact, they're about the four hardest trips away in La Liga, although maybe the Calderon, some people would argue with that. They got four against Atleti, they got three last night, they beat Barcelona, they got five against Osasuna. And they've just been, probably the best word for them this year is irresistible in the literal sense of it, in that the people just, teams just haven't been able to stop them for the most part. They've only lost twice all year.
And that makes it seven titles now for Real Madrid, is that right? I saw Mourinho, their manager, saying seven, that's seven now, is it? It's a lot.
Yeah, it's 32 for Real Madrid, although there was quite a nice one last night. There was a picture of Xabi Alonso and Esteban Granero holding up three fingers and two fingers, respectively, to make 32 league titles. But, of course, it was the old problem of facing a camera and therefore being facing the wrong way. So they were actually signalling 23. But, you know, you get the point, 32 league titles. Meanwhile, as you point out, Jose Mourinho held up seven fingers for his seventh league title. That's annoyed a few people in Spain, and it's annoyed a few people because they're saying, oh, well, there's another sign that it's all about Mourinho and not about Real Madrid if he's celebrating seven rather than 32. Mind you, I'd like to see him try and lift up enough fingers to show 32. I suppose once you get to 10, it becomes difficult. Maybe you could do 11, but that would be perhaps a bit
All right. Insert East Anglian joke here. They've lost just twice all season, and if they win their final two games, they'll have reached 100 points. That beats Barcelona's record. If they do it,
Barcelona's 99-point record, yeah. And it's—I mean, in that sense, you know, this has been a fantastic season. Real Madrid have got to—is it 115? I think 115 goals this season. The previous record was 107, so they've blown that one out of the water. By the way, I think Barcelona are going to break that as well. They're currently on 100. In fact, they already have broken it. 108. So they broke that last night. They've both broken the previous record. The number of goals they're getting is absurd. Messi on 46 for the season in the league. Cristiano Ronaldo 44. Real Madrid have got three players over 20 goals. Gonzalo Higuain and Benzema as well. And yeah, as you say, win the next two games and it'll be a points total. I do think that suggests two things. The first one is that both Madrid and Barcelona are astonishingly good teams, and they're breaking records for that reason as well. But I also do think that this, at some stage, has to force Spanish football to reflect a little bit about the ability of two clubs to dominate all of the talent.
Yeah. Imagine how many Papis Demba Cisse would get in La Liga. It doesn't bear thinking about. Final question then, Sid. Will Luis Enrique go back to Barcelona to work as Tito's number two?
I very much doubt it.
Ah.
Luis Enrique departed Barcelona to try and succeed in Italy and hasn't been able to do so. He's a slightly different character in terms of the way he approaches things to some of the people at Barcelona, including both Pep Guardiola and Tito Villanova. I must confess, from his point of view, I'm not completely convinced that he would want to go back to be a number two. So personally, I don't see it. I think we're more likely to see someone who's either within the club structure at the moment or has Barcelona links and isn't in the club structure. Maybe even someone like Chapi Ferrer.
Sid Lowe in Spain. Well, Luis Enrique heading out the door at Roma. We'll talk more about that later and who might be coming in. And who else has gone out the door in Serie A? Big story of that one. Right now, though, France. Ooh, Montpellier. They were 5 points clear, Paul Doyle. And now the gap at the top is only three. Montpellier, then Paris Saint-Germain, 3 points behind. Then Lille, only 2 points behind them. But extraordinary stuff the other night when you had Montpellier with that 2-2 draw at home to Evian when it all kicked off, Paul.
It did, yeah. They didn't play particularly well, Montpellier, in the game against Evian, who are sort of stranded in mid-table and didn't have a whole lot to play for. So it was expected to be a straightforward enough victory for Montpellier, who've been very strong at home this season. But they didn't play particularly well, but nonetheless found themselves in stoppage time at 2-2, thanks in part to a soft penalty, and their second goal was an offside goal. It shouldn't have been allowed. And then, in the third minute of stoppage time, an Ashley Young-esque fall to the ground resulted in Montpellier being given a penalty and being put on the verge of winning 3-2 in a match that would have gone a long way to giving them their first ever title. Younes Belhanda, their Moroccan playmaker who's been brilliant this season, had scored the earlier penalty in the game, but the manager, René Girard, has introduced an alternation policy for penalties between Belhanda and top scorer Olivier Giroud, because the two of them have been arguing all season over who gets to take the penalties. So Belhanda left this penalty, thinking that Giroud would step up to take it. But Giroud didn't step up to take it, instead Suleiman Kamara, who never takes penalties, stepped up to take it.
Right.
Which was a bit of a surprise. Belhanda is seen to go over and talk to him and say, what's going on? And Kamara reassured him that everything was okay. So Belhanda went back to the edge of the box and ended up getting in a fight with some Evian players.
Yeah, how did that happen? Because then he gets sent off.
Well, clearly the Evian players were discontent with the dive that led to the penalty,
right.
and one of them, Cedric Mongungu, said something to Belhanda, and the two of them ended up having sort of jostling with each other and pushing and shoving. They were both sent off. The referee allowed them to walk off the pitch together, so they punched the each other as they were going off the pitch. That led to a big melee on the sideline, featuring players, officials, and everyone bar Suleiman Kamara, who was trying to block it all out and remained on the penalty spot, trying to focus on his penalty. Two more players were shown red cards, which brought the total number of dismissals to four. Then after 5 minutes of anarchy, Kamara finally stepped up to take the penalty, and it was saved.
Oh,
so, yeah, he got on target, in fairness, but he missed. But Belhanda, who, as I said, is a very important player, but will now miss the remainder of the season.
Which includes, on May the 13th, their big clash.
Against Lille.
Is it at Lille?
It is, no, I think it's at Montpellier.
Oh, Montpellier, okay.
Yeah. Yes, and Lille are obviously back in the title race, as are PSG, who won then last night to close the gap to 3 points and probably have a slightly easier run in. But Montpellier now, it's all gone wrong for them at the crucial time. Not only are they going to be missing crucial players, but team spirit has taken a battering because Belhanda came out in the press this morning and slagged off Giroud for not stepping up to take the penalty. So it's a squeaky bum time in France.
I wonder if there's a French expression for that. Do you?
No? Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Le derrière qui parle or something, I don't know.
Not that I'm aware of.
All right, well, we'll have to keep an eye on Ligue 1 as it spirals towards its conclusion. Meantime, not so far away in exciting European football land, have a listen to this team. Company, Vermaelen, Vertonghen, Dembele, Courtois, Mignolet, Defoe, Hazard. I'm playing them a little bit out of position here. Fellaini, Witzel, De Bruyne. It sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah, plenty of fans would love to cheer that lot on. That is the Belgium, it's pretty much their starting 11, is it?
Well, you could throw in a few other players.
All right.
There, Lukaku, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And a variety of others. Yeah, and they're all young, they're all talented, and they've been playing together for about 2 or 3 years, but much like the country itself, there's a schism within the team. And
they're a bit flat.
Some speak Flemish and some speak French.
Right, it's that, is it?
And there's just huge egos, there's been huge clashes, there's been a real lack of unity and a real lack of professionalism in some cases, with players not turning up for training, going to nightclubs the day before matches, and that sort of thing. So it's a huge waste. They're still, fortunately, most of them, all those guys are still young enough to be a threat for the next World Cup.
Right. In the meantime, they're not in the Euros. They didn't even make the playoffs, Amy.
No, they very disappointingly, they had Germany in their group, which is fair enough, but Turkey were the team that they fell behind in terms of the second place spot, and Turkey went on to the playoffs, which they didn't do well in either. So I think Belgium were really fighting even more over the fact that they are aware of the qualities within their team and that it's not coming together. And it must be very frustrating, because I think what Belgium have done is been quite clever in I think you can root a lot of their success in terms of producing players to the example really of maybe France in 1998, and a lot of those countries, Switzerland and so on around there, when they saw what France achieved in that era, made a real effort to make sure they were getting second generation players from outside of the homeborn country. And Belgium, if you look at that lineup, I mean, Kompany has a Congolese dad. Lukaku is also of Congolese descent. Fellaini is Moroccan, his parents. Witzel is Martinique. Dembele from Mali. They made a real effort, and Switzerland did the same, and they obviously come on a lot in leaps and bounds on the international scene to make sure that these players are choosing, in this case, Belgium or Switzerland or whoever, and not the country of their parents. And they've got a much better pool of players now than they have had in the previous few years.
Presumably, and that also helps the whole kind of French-Flemish schism as well, if you dilute the no?
Well, as far as I understand it, the difference between Belgium and France and Switzerland is that whereas in France it was a centralised thing driven by the federation, in Belgium they couldn't get that together at all, and it was individual clubs pursuing this policy.
Oh.
So it happened that a lot of them pursued it,
because it made them easier to field as players for the clubs if they were declared French. Interesting. Well, this was a subject that was brought up by Henk 1040 and Debaser 92, who were discussing this on the message boards this week. Was there also something about boots with that problem with boots? Was it hiding boots or not bringing boots?
There was what do you call him? He wasn't one of the younger players in Penza.
Right.
For a qualifier, I think it was away in Azerbaijan, and he was on the bench, and he was told to warm up, and he said, "Actually, boss, I forgot my boots."
Bless. All right. Well, producer Ben says we could waffle on about this for a long time, but we've got to move on now. Nice one, producer Ben. Ooh, Holland. Quick mention to them. Frank de Boer led Ajax to their 31st title, his second successive championship since taking over from Martin Jol. But Ajax were lying sixth last time we looked, back in February. And then you remember that kerfuffle when Van Gaal went up against Cruyff, and Cruyff got him barred in the courts from taking over as a director. And since then, the club went on to win their next 13 games. Absolutely extraordinary stuff. Well done, Ajax. Mm. In other Euro news, hey, Motherwell set for the Champions League. They're going to set Rangers' place in the Champions League qualifiers, because Rangers are banned because of, you know, their problems. And meanwhile, in Serie A, two games to go, midweek round. Juve only drew at home to Lecce. Gigi Buffon tried to dribble past Bertolacci of relegation strugglers Lecce and got caught out, and it was a 1-1 draw. Lecce were down to 10 men at this point. So Milan are now just a point behind. Ooh. With two games to go, what's, one of which...
What's squeaky bum time in Italian?
Well, they don't really have an equivalent expression, actually. I don't know. Or maybe they do, and I just don't know about it. If you know of one, you know, we have a broad listenership. So, but there you go. Milan have, of course, the Milan derby coming up this weekend against Inter, who lost. They were on a real run under their new manager, unbeaten in the league under Stramaccioni, and they were one of these four teams, all tied on the same number of points, in third place. But they lost at Parma, another brilliant game by Giovinco. So now that means that Napoli and Udinese are tied together, 2 points clear of Lazio, with Inter a further point behind. And Roma, meanwhile, drew, so they look well out of the picture on a waterlogged pitch at Chievo. And everybody's now saying that it's definite. Luis Enrique's gone. Not only that, but they know who's going to be coming in. And it is? Do you know this one? Who might be taking over at Roma? Throw a name at me.
Capello.
No. He's been there before, of course, and successfully. But, no, how about Andre Villas-Boas? Because things went wrong for him at Chelsea, because in that case he had to deal with an ageing group of players with some massive egos that weren't willing to... Whereas at... Oh, yeah, Roma... Yeah, all right. Well, anyway, it's going to be an interesting experiment then for the Giallorossi if they go with that. And the papers are saying it's all sorted.
Hmm? What happened at Fiorentina?
Happened at Fiorentina? Well, Greg, thanks for asking. We're up to our 19th... change of the season, managerial changes, because Delia Rossi's been fired. Previous record was 15, which is not bad going in a 20-team division.
Yeah,
this is 19 now, and there's still two games to go. So, you know, watch this space. So
does that mean every club but one has changed, or have
no,
a couple of teams
have
changed
through.
More than once?
Fiorentina, for example, this is their second change, because they had Mihalovic, they got rid of him and brought in Delia Rossi.
Inter have had a few changes.
Well, Inter has started off with Gasperini, went to Claudio Ranieri, and now have Stramaccioni, at least at the time of publication. And
who are Fiorentina going to appoint? For
well, they have appointed Vincenzo Guerini,
okay.
But it's basically just to get them to the end of the season. There are other, I could go through other clubs who have been through, like for example Genoa, who fired Malassani twice, and now on their and they got a win under their new man.
Did Fiorentina have a choice over this?
No, this is the thing. Sorry, we haven't mentioned the thing you're talking about. What actually happened to Fiorentina?
Yeah.
Okay, so Fiorentina, Delia Rossi had finally been getting some success with the Florence side, and they were at home to the now relegated Novara. But 31 minutes in, things were going very, very badly. They were 2-0 down. Indeed, and he decides to sub off the underperforming Lajcic, who's not really been setting the world on fire in Florence and was only really playing because Jovetic wasn't fit. And as he comes off, Lajcic does that sarcastic thing of a bit of applause to the manager and then gives him a thumbs up, sits down on the bench and must have said something, because Delia Rossi, who's just studiously ignored him, turns round, races towards him and gives him an absolute whapping slap on the side of the face, goes in for another, slips, falls into the dugout, and is just lining up a right hook when one of the other coaching staff basically holds him back. And it all kind of finishes there. But extraordinary scenes, of course, when people are racing over to see what's going on and try and calm things down. Anyway, so then Delia Rossi gets back out and stands on the touchline, and the final 15 minutes of the half go by. And the crowd, interestingly enough, are chanting Delia Rossi's name and singing one or two ironic chants about Lajcic, because they have long held the opinion that the players are basically overpaid sport brats, etc., and they probably would have dearly loved to have slapped them up, and which is quite often the case in Italy, of course. But anyway, he came out for the second half, Delia Rossi, but straight after the game, the Della Valles, who are very careful about the whole kind of values and doing the right thing business at Florence, said it's a real shame, he's a nice chap, we don't know why this happened, he's offered to apologise, but no, this is a sackable offence and he has to go, and he's gone.
There's an obvious replacement.
Sorry, Paul?
There's an obvious replacement for him.
Who's that then?
Paolo Di Canio.
Hey, Paolo Di Canio, yeah. Who kicked one of his players up the bum this season at Swindon, didn't he? Well, there's plenty of managers out there who believe that it's entirely within their remit or even their duty in the kind of tough love category to get physical.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's generally that sort of thing happens to take place behind closed doors.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not normally the kind of thing you see. I mean, famously...
Naked in the dressing room in certain cases in England with a headbutt.
But yeah. I was minded when I watched...
Is that the Tony Pulis story?
Yeah.
Sorry. I was minded when I watched that clip of Delia Rossi of the famous story of Brian Laws throwing a plate of chicken wings at Ivano Bonetti when at Grimsby.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is probably right up there in terms of managers losing their temper against their players.
That story staggered the Italians. I remember that was one of the... That was just completely beyond. In the same way that you tell some stories about Serie A over here and people go, oh, I don't believe it. But the Italians are absolutely dumbfounded that a manager would do that and that it would be seen as... It, that he wouldn't be slung in jail, basically. It was almost accepted as the norm in England.
Well, let's just try and imagine if we were sitting here today and a Premier League manager had gone and attacked their own player.
What, kicked a boot at one of his players?
No, well, again, that took place. We didn't see it. That was only something that we heard about afterwards.
Wasn't it? Was that why, imagine that's why Italians were...
Well, why was a plate of chicken wings in the dressing room anyway?
I have no idea, yeah.
But in all seriousness, if Mancini had gone for Tevez, for example, the reaction would have been probably a little bit different than we all sit here and have a snigger about.
Delia Rossi. I'm not sniggering about it, to be fair. And you were, I think, sorry, I'm not sniggering about it, to be fair. And Delia Rossi as well, one of the surprises about this is that he's always been a very, how can I put this? He's always been one of the more kind of intelligent cerebral managers. He's never done, I mean, he's done some interesting things. He famously burst into tears when Salernitana won promotion once. And what else did he do? He stripped off to his underpants in December and went swimming in a Rome fountain because that was a promise that he'd made before a Rome derby, and they duly won and he did it. And then all the Roma fans tweeted that they'd urinated in the fountain before, and it's a bit unfortunate. But anyway, there's never been anything like this. He'd never lashed out or anything. But in this country, I mean, the Cluffy example of the Roy Keane tells in his autobiography, the best thing that Cluffy ever did was hit me in the dressing room after I'd misplaced a pass against Crystal Palace. It taught me a lot as a footballer. And you know what? Jacob Steinberg was getting all excited about John Sitton, which I'd never seen this. I know people may know this. Do you know this one, Greg?
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, Orient Team for a Fiver. Team this happened five, while I was away in the 90s. And have you seen this, Amy? Extraordinary half-time team talk where he fires one player amid an extraordinary stream of expletives just in front of the rest of the team. He's telling them all off, and he says to one of them, you'll be fired like John is. Turns to John, says, you see me in the morning, you've got 2 weeks' notice. And then he continues on. He tells two other players to do as they're told, otherwise they can come and take him on, and they can bring a friend, and they can bring their dinner too, because by the time he's finished with them, they're going to need it. It's absolutely amazing. Look for it. It's Orient Team for a Five, a half-time team
this
talk.
This is the kind of thing apparently Liverpool are going to be opening the doors up to as well.
Of course, Greg.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, it's really worrying that they're going to do that. So,
is it?
Well, I think so.
Do I not like that? It's one of the greatest
It's great entertainment, but it's, yeah. I mean, this is another thing which is a complete departure from what you would call Liverpool values of the past. And,
right.
You know, and I'm very surprised that Dalglish wouldn't go mad about this and say this isn't the way the club does things.
Loving the cameras the way he does.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Who knows what he'll get up to.
Do I not like that? If you're not familiar with that, that's another thing you should. You can see the whole thing on YouTube if you like. It's an extraordinary, epochal documentary which followed the yet another brilliant decision by the FA to allow a TV production company, the same ones who did Gazzetta Football Italia, if you're curious, to mic up England manager Graham Taylor for England's disastrous qualifiers for the 1994 World Cup. Good. Anybody want to add anything there about managers hitting players hitting managers? No? Or England managers? No? Oh, well, yeah, England managers! Do you know what? We were just talking about Belgium. I completely forgot to say that, of course, Belgium are playing. It's a high-profile friendly that's been organised for the new-look team England. They're playing Belgium and Norway before the Euros to get new manager Roy Hodgson up to speed. Well, anyway, are you a Roy Hodgson fan?
Yeah. I think he's exactly the manager England need, because he, although the main criticism of him seems to be that he can't handle big players and et cetera and so on. But I think England, in international terms, are on a similar level to West Brom and Fulham, with whom he had great success. And England's most realistic chance of winning tournaments is to play counter-attacking football and maximising set pieces and that sort of thing, the way they beat Spain recently under Capella. And Hodgson is more likely to play that than Redknapp is.
Mm. Although the counter to that usually is that when he does get less glamorous teams to overperform, it's because the players are filled with desire because they realise that they have to work hard.
Yeah, so England players need to realise that's where they're at.
Yeah.
I just worry whether he'll have enough time to really put his message across to the players.
Isn't lack of time his biggest advantage with them, given the way that their teams are always so bored under Hodgson? supposedly?
Well, I don't know, but I just think, you know, he doesn't strike me as the kind of manager who is a one for an instant quick fix. Hmm. I think he probably needs a little bit of...
I think that's why they brought him in, though, isn't it? Because the long-term absolutely. Approach and the fact that the Burton coaching centre is going to open and he's going to take an interest in the youth setup. And
yeah, but then wouldn't it have made sense to have had perhaps, you know, two people coming in? One to look after that kind of bigger picture role for the national team and one to look after the first team as a coach to deal with... Yeah. You know, short-term bursts with your players.
I wonder whether they want the coach, though, who's getting this final product, to have more knowledge of what's coming through rather than suddenly just trying to do something at the top end with them, which is what I imagine Harry Redknapp would have done. He'd have taken an interest in the first team and probably not much of an interest in anything
below. Yeah, but if you look at, say, for example, Germany, who recently have been, you know, very good at producing young players while their first team is doing rather well, or how the French team did it in the late 90s and early 2000s, there were different people who were effectively technical directors in charge of the whole system, and a different head coach who was in charge of the first team. And I think there was great relationships between them, were important, but
isn't there
it wasn't
who's
all
a technical
under,
director
under one person.
Don't England have a technical director, though? Trevor Brookings?
Well, then why doesn't he oversee the project at Burton?
Yeah, I agree, because although I think Roy Hutchins is a good man to look after the first team at the moment, in the long term, you'd hope that England are going to try and cultivate a style of football that is more than just counter-attacking and playing to the current strengths that they have, you know, like an Ajax-type thing, that sort of more enterprising type of football, which Hutchins isn't particularly well known for.
We also need to just only pick up, you know, a tabloid newspaper to see the distinction between the long-term, bigger picture view of what we're talking about, that, you know, that the FA want to come from this appointment, and what the people and certain people are going to be judging this England manager on. So, and on that note, just, you know, nobody wants to go on and on about it, but, you know, I don't know what was more disappointing or more offensive, actually, the Sun headline that has had a lot of talk about it, or the following day when we get Jonathan Ross being some kind of arbiter of the moral compass of the nation, telling us what is and isn't acceptable.
Indeed.
Can I just clarify what I meant there, in case it sounded like I was contradicting myself?
Oh,
I think Hutchins, a good man to manage the England first team at the moment, but somebody else should be in charge of Burton in the long term.
All right, good one. Now then, part three awaits after this. Hey, Premier League weekend. And Clint Harvey says, is this the best finish to a Premier League season in a long while? Is it? Is it, Greg?
It's pretty exciting. Oof. I mean, last time it was as close as this, or felt like it was as close as this, was the Blackburn and Man United in 1995.
Well, I don't know about then. I mean, this time you've got the excitement not only of the top two being level on points, but you've also got that massive thing going on for the Champions League places, and down the bottom is ever so tight as well, isn't it?
Should we
talk about the situation at the bottom? You've got, well, of course, Wolves already gone, Blackburn now on the verge. They've got to play Wigan at home this weekend, and then they're at Chelsea. Aye, aye, aye. And then above them, you've got Bolton, who've got West Brom. Of course, the England effect there, they won't win any more games now, will they? And then they're away to Stoke. And above them, QPR, who are facing Stoke this time around, and then they're away to Man City. What does it all mean, Amy?
I think Bolton will be really cheesed off with themselves after their performance against Spurs, where they fought quite hard. They were terrible in the first half and were quite fortunate only to be a goal down, and then recovered really well at the beginning of the second half and got themselves back into it with a good goal. And it, you know, they were the team who were putting all the pressure on, and then all of a sudden, with three goals in a fantastic 9-minute spell of brilliant counter-attacking, who's to say Harry Redknapp can't do counter-attacking football as well as Roy Hodgson, Tottenham were, you know, the game was gone. But Bolton, I think we're looking at that as a, obviously, Tottenham haven't been doing very well away from home, is a game that they might have got something from, and it was, I think, very chastening for them. But their next game at home to West Brom is absolutely, I think, the one that will decide how they do, because QPR have got really, really difficult fixtures in the next two games.
Stoke and Man City, I mean, I just see QPR going down.
Yeah, I think that if Bolton can pull themselves together to win against West Brom at home, then they've got a chance again.
Well, Villa and Wigan are only 3 points clear. Wigan, we mentioned, they're at Blackburn. That's a huge game. Were Rovers to win that, then, of course, Wigan are right back in the whole kind of relegation mess. So Wigan finish off, though, by hosting Wolves, which, to be fair, is a little bit easier. Villa as well, they're against Spurs this weekend. Spurs, eh? Oh. And then they're at Norwich, so again, yeah, that's a bit easy. But I'm just saying, it could all, you know.
I wouldn't be very comfortable if I was a Villa fan.
No.
At the
moment. No. All right.
I still think it's between QPR and Bolton, looking at it.
So Blackburn definitely to go, and then either QPR and Bolton.
Yeah.
QPR should win this weekend, because Stoke are awful away for some reason.
Right. Also this weekend, mentioned the top four, we kind of did that in part one. Remember back then? Happy days. But in the title race on Sunday, Newcastle, Man City. That game on Monday night that we said was going to decide the title, it didn't. This one, though. This is going to be the one that sorts out the Premier League champions once and for all, eh?
Well, that was, I think, one of the added extra bonuses for the Chelsea-Newcastle game, because it needed Newcastle to have that result to really make this this Newcastle City game just absolutely explosively, wonderfully brilliant, as I'm sure that the television presenters will tell us
it's going
to be.
The biggest Premier League game ever.
Yeah, Newcastle will certainly put up more of a fight than United did.
Right. And, Roberto Mancini making that very point. He says this game will be tougher than the derby was.
Yeah, well, Newcastle, they'll play with two up front, which Ferguson couldn't bring himself to do. They'll play their most attacking players, and they'll have genuine presence in midfield, which United didn't have.
All right.
Is Cheick Tiote seemingly going to be okay after that?
Well, apparently he was lobotomized.
Apparently, Pardew said he had a 9-inch gash in his head that required 400 stitches.
400?
Yeah, I was saying, how small were these stitches? And we're like, was it cross-stitching or... Well, that's just incredible. And he said, oh, yeah, but it's only a scratch for him, so he'll be back at the weekend.
He's a warrior.
Tis but a scratch.
Well, yeah, tis but a scratch. So apparently his head fell off, and I think he's put it back on again last night, and I'm not sure whether it'd be facing the right way on at the weekend.
Well, that's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Should we not just make mention of the fact that that was pretty appalling behaviour from Mikel?
Although Pardew said it was just one of those things. Like,
did he?
He didn't.
Well, I just thought it seemed so obvious that it was a response to. I mean, Tiote had been, borderline a little bit over hard with his attempt not so long previously. But it was such an obvious reaction that I think there was that clear intent there.
An obvious reaction to Mikel thinking that this guy's going to sign by Chelsea next year and take my position in this team.
Pardew, though, just looked so fired up by the whole thing. There he was, fist
he just
pumping.
He looks so excited. He's enjoying it.
He wanted
it
to
so
get
much.
Out there.
Well, he's like, I guess he's feeling how the Newcastle fans are feeling, which is it almost feels like a bonus for him this season, which is very patronising and, not fair reflection of the fantastic work that everybody behind the scenes has done at Newcastle to make this such an exciting season for them. But you can't blame them for getting carried away. You know, they've had a season full of some really good high points and a couple of pretty.
They were terrible.
I saw them at Spurs when they lost 5-0 and they looked absolutely awful. But there have been so many positive things. And
they've
team
always bounced back. That's the thing. Whenever they've had it, and Pardew was making this point yesterday, straight off the Wigan game, once again, they bounced back with a terrific performance. Mm. So United went to Ursula St. James's Park and lost 3-0. And they've got Swansea at home this weekend. What's going to be the situation at the top come Monday?
I've got a feeling that Newcastle will draw with City.
Ooh.
And I think that means Man United will go on and win the league. I've just got a feeling that Newcastle will score against City and make it very hard for them. And I'm quite disappointed, really, if that was the case. But I've got to go with what my head's telling me, and I think it'll be like a 2-2 draw or something.
Really, they've had 15 clean sheets for Newcastle. Paul, what do you think? Another one on Sunday?
I'm with Greg.
Yeah.
Not too sure what he said in the end.
Okay. Right, good. So you guys are both going for a Man City draw?
I'm going to go for a draw. I think Newcastle will concede goals. He won't keep another clean sheet. I think it'll be an exciting
the question.
Game.
Is will Aguero score enough? Because he's been so frustrating at the amount of chances he's missed.
Yeah. Mm.
I was just going to say, talking of the clean sheets for Newcastle, that a little bit of credit to Tim Krul, who perhaps isn't the most discussed goalkeeper in the Premier League this season, but has been a really good purchase for Newcastle.
My word. Okay, and Man United to get past Swansea at home without any problems?
Probably.
All right. Interesting. Well, the weekend awaits listeners, as does a tip-top paper review featuring punches up in Europe and that kind of thing on iTunes and The Guardian's website on Friday morning. We'll be back on Monday with Football Weekly, but in the meantime, it's many thanks to producer Ben, to Greg Bukowski,
thank you,
to Paul Doyle and Amy Lawrence, and we hope you have a lovely weekend and we'll speak to you on Monday.